Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Spring is celebrated as revival. In the Christian world, it is Easter, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, known as the Prince of Peace, and also as Prince of Jews. From the very beginning of Christianity, a bitter estrangement from its parent religion escalated persecution of Jews until, nearly 2,000 years later, European Jewry was decimated by a savage ideology that dehumanized them as vermin and murdered millions, known to history as the Holocaust. All roads lead to Rome is an ancient axiom. During World War II, it seemed as if every railroad track in Europe led to Auschwitz. Hatred and intolerance are on the rise worldwide in the second decade of the 21st century, a virulence never at rest even when periodically subdued by revulsion of its excesses. Falsifiers of history exhort masses to exterminate minorities or members of inconvenient theologies. Genocide wears a cosmetic of ethnic cleansing. With Women's History Month drawing to a close, today's program is about two young Jewish women who died in the infamous Nazi death camps of World War II, but whose names remain immortal. The first is Anne Frank, the other is Charlotte Solomon. I originally wrote these accounts for earlier radio shows and have combined and rewritten them for today's program. I take responsibility for any errors. The first, Anne Frank's visit to Astoria. Anne Frank died in the Nazi concentration camp Bergen-Belsen 72 years ago this month on March 12, 1945. Ostensibly of typhus fever, following her older sister Margot's death of the same disease. She was 15. There are at least two published versions of her famous diary. The early version heavily edited by her father, Otto Frank, the second unexpurgated and released also by him. Both versions are from a rewrite she made of her original diary after learning of British interest in daily life in Nazi-occupied countries. An online version of the diary was released on January 1st this year, despite strenuous objections by the Anne Frank Fonds, a foundation established by her father, who died at age 90 in 1980. She kept her diary. She named it Kitty, while hiding for 2 years in an attic in Holland with her family, another family, and a friend. She was a young Jewish girl from Germany, at grave risk from Jewish exterminating Nazis who had conquered Holland in 1940. She started the diary a month before she and her family escaped a German call-up of Jews living in Amsterdam in July 1942. She had received the diary as a birthday present and continued it until 3 days before the 8 occupants of the secret annex were betrayed and captured. "I keep looking for a way of becoming what I really want to be and what I could be," she wrote on August 1, 1944, her last entry. Her father, Otto, was the only member of her family to escape death in the concentration camps. Her mother was gassed at Auschwitz. She and her older sister, Margot, died of typhus within weeks of each other at Bergen-Belsen. Margot died first. A woman who knew Anne in the camp said, "In Auschwitz, we had visible enemies, but in Bergen-Belsen, we were left to ourselves. There, we had not even hatred to buoy us up. We had only ourselves and our filthy bodies. We had only thirst, hunger, and the dead, the corpses lying all around, who showed us what a little thing life is. There it took a superhuman effort to remain alive. Typhus and debilitation, well, yes. But I feel certain that Anne died of her sister's death. Dying is frightfully easy for anyone left alone in a concentration camp." Anne Frank might have slipped away from history, consumed with anonymous millions of others who perished in Nazi death camps. Her diary was saved. The Germans ignored her books and papers when she was arrested with the others. Two Dutch women, friends of the Franks, who had aided them through the 2 years of hiding, found the diary on the floor of the attic. "We sat down on the floor and leafed through all the papers," one said. "They were all Anne's, the notebooks, and the colored duplicate paper from the office, too. We gathered them up and took them down with us, downstairs. We locked up all of it." They gave the diary to Otto Frank when he returned after the war. Thus was her voice preserved out of the millions that were silenced, Ernst Schrabel wrote at the end of his book, Anne Frank, A Portrait in Courage. This voice no louder than a child's whisper. It tells how those millions lived, ate, and slept, and it has outlasted the shouts of the murderers and has soared above the voices of time. Thousands more stories and accounts of the Holocaust have emerged, yet her voice remains the most compelling. She wrote in her diary 3 weeks before the Nazis captured her family, "It's really a wonder that I haven't dropped all my ideals because they seem so absurd and impossible to carry them out. Yet I keep them, because in spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart. I simply can't build up my hopes on a foundation consisting of confusion, misery, and death. I see the world gradually being turned into a wilderness. I hear the ever-approaching thunder, which will destroy us too. I can feel the sufferings of millions, and yet if I look up to the heavens, I think that it will all come out right, that this cruelty too will end, and that peace and tranquility will return again. In the meantime, I must uphold my ideals, for perhaps the time will come when I shall be able to carry them out." These are the thoughts and expressions of a young girl living under extraordinary conditions, Eleanor Roosevelt wrote about the diary. And for this reason, her diary tells us much about ourselves and about our own children. And for this reason, in her diary, too, I felt how close we all are to Anne's experience, how very much involved we are in her short life and in the entire world. And that was Eleanor Roosevelt. The Clatsop County Human Relations Task Force sponsored a visit of the Anne Frank Community Exhibit in Astoria in late 1993. Its purpose was to demonstrate the dangers and evils of discrimination through the memory of a young girl whose diary of hiding from Nazi killers who eventually found her made her, posthumously, an immortal child. An exhibit of photographs, artwork, videos, including Dear Kitty, which is about her diary, and speakers who survived the Holocaust or personally witnessed it, visited the North Oregon coast at the First Presbyterian Church Annex. And the Napa High School Thespians performed a theatrical version of the Diary of Anne Frank in conjunction with the exhibit. The Anne Frank Foundation, located in Amsterdam in the building where the Frank family hid, organized the original exhibit after receiving a photo album of the family from a woman who refused to reveal her identity. Otto Frank identified the photographs, blended with photographs and documentation of Europe during the growth of Nazi racist philosophies and World War II, the Frank photos became the heart of the exhibition Anne Frank in the World, 1929 to 1945, Lessons for Humanity. 7,000 persons viewed the Anne Frank exhibit in Astoria, which was held from November 15th to December 5th, 1993. 4,000 of them were children. The original exhibit and its touring clones, such as the exhibit in Astoria, had four major themes. These were, as described by the Times Union of Albany, New York, in a special supplement about the exhibit's appearance the previous year at the College of St. Rose, that discrimination is cruel and irrational, that ordinary citizens discriminate, that ordinary people can isolate their fellow citizens for persecution on the basis of race, gender, ethnic descent, or sexual choice, that discrimination is a matter of personal choice, that ethnic descent or nationality does not determine whether the individual will take a stand against violation of human rights, that discrimination and racism, like anti-Semitism, not only existed in the past, but are persistent today. The Foundation published a book of the exhibit. These questions were asked in the book's foreword. Had Anne Frank, a typical child, lived next door, could she have counted on us for help during the Nazi regime? Would we have recognized the dangers of fascism, or would we have believed the propaganda that depicted Jews as inferior, untrustworthy citizens? Would we have agreed with those who singled out the Jews as the cause of all evil, just as some people today feel free to blame the foreigners for all their ills? Or would we have continued, perhaps with a feeling of powerlessness, our daily routine? The Astoria exhibit had over 100 sponsors and donors and 200 volunteers. School children participated in a One Earth, One People art contest, which was won by Astoria High School junior Kendra Smith. The Daily Astorian featured daily profiles of speakers, most of whom were survivors of Nazi death camps or witnesses to the persecution of Jews in Nazi-occupied Europe during World War II. KMUN-FM devoted portions of its daily broadcasting to the exhibit, in particular exhibit organizer Carol Newman, who discussed the Holocaust and contemporary racial, ethnic, gender, and sexual choice persecutions on her programs. It's ordinary people like you and I who elected Hitler, Debbie Ritano, organizer of the Anne Frank exhibit in Albany, New York, said to an interviewer. Ordinary people like you and I who became perpetrators of the crime, and ordinary people like you and me who became the victims. The problem is, Ritano said, that some SS uniform can walk up to you in the real preppy suit of a David Duke of the KKK, or in the roles of a Cardinal Glemp. You're not facing a swastika, but it's in a different form. Anne Frank's life was short, but her memory will most likely be preserved through her diary for the rest of human history. And that was something I wrote on Frank's visit to Astoria. And now something else I wrote about Charlotte Solomon, Life or Theater. Charlotte Solomon was a young Jewish artist in Nazi Germany at the advent of World War II. She was a woman of courage and insight who desperately attempted to leave a record of her life before the Nazis caught up to her. She was born in Berlin in 1917, which would make her 100 years old this year. She was the daughter of a cultured Jewish surgeon. When she was 9 years old, her mother committed suicide. She was told her mother died of influenza or pneumonia. And when she was 12, her father married a famous opera singer. Charlotte was a morose child, abnormally shy and slow of speech, and she worshipped her stepmother. Charlotte was 16 when the Nazis came to power in Germany in 1933. 4 years later, as a 20-year-old art student at the Berlin Art Academy, she met and fell in love with a man nearly twice her age, whom she named Amadeus Daberlohn in her autobiographical paintings. His real name was Alfred Wolfson. Daberlohn Wolfson was a voice teacher with extreme theories of art and personality that made others either admire him as a prophet or pity him as a self-deceived charlatan. His philosophy had its beginning during World War I when he was buried by an exploding artillery shell for several days underneath the bodies of several dying German soldiers. He suffered severe shell shock and spent much of his life developing a theory of voice from the sounds of dying soldiers. Not long after Charlotte's affair with Wolfson began, the Nazi government initiated its extermination of Europe's Jewish population with German Jews. Her father was briefly interned in a Nazi concentration camp in November 1938 after Kristallnacht, and the family decided to leave Germany. Wolfson, who was obsessed with Charlotte's stepmother at the same time he conducted his affair with Charlotte, became engaged to another woman and left with her for England, where he died in 1962. Charlotte, brokenhearted by Wolfson's departure, was sent to the south of France to escape the Nazis and stay with her maternal grandparents near Nice. Her father and stepmother migrated to Holland. After the Second War began in September 1939, Charlotte's grandmother fell into a state of despondency and committed suicide. It was only then, when Charlotte was desperately trying to save the old lady, that she first learned that her mother had killed herself. She also heard that her grandmother's mother and nephew, her maternal great uncle, and her own Aunt Charlotte, after whom she had been named, had also committed suicide. With the Nazi danger steadily approaching, Charlotte was also threatened from within as well by the family doom. In a letter she never sent, she wrote, "My life commenced when my grandmother wanted to take her life, when I found out that my mother had taken hers, as had her entire family, when I found out that I was the only survivor, and when deep within me I felt the same inclination, the urge towards despair and dying." Charlotte spent 2 years secluded in a small French hotel, working obsessively, painting her life. She called her work a play with music and titled it Life or Theater. There are 796 paintings in watercolor, known as gouaches, a technique of painting with opaque watercolors prepared with gum. She shut herself up in a French hotel and painted her autobiography, starting from the courtship of her parents during World War I when her father was a German army doctor and her mother an army nurse, and ended more or less with the day she started the work. The paper she used was 10 inches by 13 inches. Her paints were red, blue, yellow, and white. Her autobiography could be considered an escape from her present reality and the approaching Nazis, particularly after the invasion of France in the spring of 1940. Yet at the same time, she plunged into a past that she felt necessary to understand. She sought self-knowledge and saw it through with great courage, intelligence, and creativity. She described herself in the third person as simply Charlotte. One of her most ominous paintings shows rows of parading Nazis under an angry red flag inscribed with a swastika. At the end, in a frantic effort to finish before she was captured, she rapidly filled her papers with words painted with her brush. Just before her capture, she had married a fellow exile and gave her paintings to the village doctor where she lived in Vichy, France. She died in Auschwitz on October 10th, 1943, gassed with her unborn child. She was 26. After the war, her father and stepmother, who had survived as fugitives in Nazi-occupied Holland with help from the Dutch underground, traveled to France and visited the village doctor who gave them Charlotte's paintings. They donated them to the Jewish Historical Museum in Amsterdam in 1971 after several exhibitions at the museum and at least one book printing of 80 of the paintings in 1963. In 1981, the museum published all 796 paintings in book form. It is an unusual book, almost every painting inscribed with text in German she wrote with her paintbrush, which is translated into English at the top of every page in the book. The paintings have been compared to Anne Frank's diary, which the museum's director, Judith Belafonte, considered unfair to both works, to the adolescent spontaneity of the one as to the conscious artistry of the other. Anne Frank, who was 14 when she wrote her diary, quote, described the day-to-day life in hiding, attempting in that way to deal with problems that were in themselves insoluble, Belafonte wrote, while Charlotte Solomon, nearly 10 years older, her own youth behind her, had used her own life to give new meaning to an existence that had been declared by the world to be of no meaning. It would be difficult to convey the impact of Charlotte's story without the paintings. So I will read from the end of her book where there are no paintings, just a rush of words covering every final page. It is soon after France's surrender to the Nazis. In the last painting but one, she says to her grandfather, "The world must be put back together again." He retorts that she should commit suicide and stop her babbling. And she writes in a surge of words, "This took place in July 1940, en route from a little town in the Pyrenees to Nice. one year later, during which the world fell ever more apart, the spirit of this strangely twin-natured creature, Charlotte, was ever more crushed by the proximity of her grandfather, tragically hounded as he was by fate. And since this applied to everyone at that time, so that no one was able to listen to anyone else but immediately began to talk about himself, there awoke in a suffering yet somehow aloof creature a sense of the helplessness of all those who try to grasp at straws in the most violent thunderstorms. Despite her utter weakness, however, she refused to be drawn into the circle of the straw graspers and remained alone with her experiences and her paintbrush. Yet, in the long run, to live day and night like this became intolerable, even to a creature thus predisposed, and she found herself facing the question of whether to commit suicide or to undertake something wildly eccentric. She was able to have some rest while at the same time having a perfect opportunity to become fully acquainted with human beings and to learn and to hate, love, or despise them. Thus, in the presence of the scorching sun, purple sea, and luxuriant blossoms, the memory of an experience of her fervid early love came back to her, and she tried to visualize that face, that figure. And lo, she succeeded, and she noticed that this was a very interesting occupation, for she discovered that that figure might possibly preserve her from suicide, inasmuch as she remembered one of Amadeus's favorite utterances, love. Know thyself first in order to love thy neighbor. And then one has got to go into oneself, into one's childhood, to be able to go out of oneself. And he felt that the movie was the machine of modern man as a means of going out of oneself. And finally she recalled the famous couple embracing under a bathrobe, functioning as one person. And now something strange happened to our Charlotte. While busy painting as she always was, she fell asleep in the midday sun. And when she awoke, the finished portrait of her once so ardently beloved Amadeus lay before her. However, she tore the sheet into 100,000 shreds, which she threw into the wind. Then she sat down and tried to fall asleep again, and the experiment succeeded once more. Again, it was the face of our Amadeus, but this time in profile, turned toward a standing figure, Charlotte, and she sought for an explanation for this strange happening. Then her glance fell on one of her old paintings, representing Death and the Maiden, and suddenly she knew two things. First, that D'Aberlon's eyes seemed to say, Death and the Maiden, that's the two of us. And second, that she still loved him as much as ever. And if he was Death, then everything was all right. Then she did not have to kill herself like her ancestors, for according to his method, one can be resurrected. In fact, in order to love life still more, one should once have died. So she was, in fact, the living model for his theories, and she remembered his book, Orpheus, or The Way to a Death Mask, of which he had said that he regretted not having written it as a poem. And with dream-awakened eyes, she saw all the beauty around her, saw the sea, felt the sun, and knew she had to vanish for a while from the human plane and make every sacrifice in order to create her world out of the depths. And from that came life or theater, life or theater. That was the last page and the final painting in Charlotte's book. She painted herself from the back, sitting on the beach, looking at the sea. Her body is bright orange, and the sea and sky vividly blue. On her back is inscribed in German, Leben, Orte, Theater. Charlotte, whose stepmother, Paula Solomon Lindbergh, was an opera singer, has her own opera, Charlotte, which was composed by Marc-André Dalbrave and premiered on July 28, 2014, in Salzburg, Germany. The libretto by Barbara Honigman was based on the paintings, which were integrated into the performance. In February 2015, a ballet opera by Michelle DiBucci was based on Charlotte's life and work and won Germany's highest honor in theater that year, the Die Faust Award. And a primary school in Berlin and a street were dedicated to Charlotte Solomon, and a plaque commemorating her was placed in front of a house in Berlin she had lived in. And that was Charlotte, Life or Theater. And thanks to Helen Patti, whose birthday is tomorrow, for her gift as a Christmas present 35 years ago, Charlotte Solomon's book, life or theater, an autobiographical play. And a special thanks for her magnanimous gift 30 years ago in the spring of 1987 of the House KMUN volunteers reincarnated into a radio station. And I wish to thank those who pledged to KMUN this past week. Donald Trump wishes to completely defund public broadcasting, probably fantasizing transferring the assets for his own special network, Trump Broadcasting Corporation, or Radio Trumpica with a K, that will be all about him all of the time, every moment of every day. It is estimated that the planned increase in the military budget would fund PBS for at least two centuries. Trump threw down the gauntlet, calling all media fake news and the enemy of the people, which in essence trashes First Amendment freedoms of press, speech, and thought. Trump's blatant and deceitful attempt to stifle criticism or scrutiny of his presidency makes him the common enemy to most media, except Fox News, Breitbart, and other right-wing disinformation media. We should take heart from the imperishable words of Patrick Henry, who said today, on March 23, 1775, less than a month before the beginning of the American Revolution, "I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death." This has been Michael McCusker.